Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is a name that may be familiar to a lot of you, particularly those who follow his email updates about the Texas legislature every 2 years. It's Jerry Bullard from Adams, Lynch & Lofton here in the DFW area. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
Oh, happy to do it. I'm honored that you've asked.
Well, Jerry is both kind of a legislative expert and an appellate lawyer, and he does both things very well. But Jerry, for those who don't know you or maybe don't follow your emails or just kind of follow them and don't know much, just kind of tell us a little bit about your background, you know, how you got to where you are and what you do these days.
Well, when the legislature's not in session, my real job is, just like you gentlemen, is a civil appellate practitioner. You know, I've been practicing law since 1991. It's hard to believe that I'm almost 30 years into this gig as a lawyer. But, somewhere along the line, and I can go into that more detail if anybody's interested in that sort of a thing about how I took a turn towards the legislature. But, you know, I've been a civil appellate lawyer like you two really since about 1995 is when I started really trying to get into a specialty area such as appellate law. And I've been doing that ever since. You know, I don't hop around a whole lot. I've been with my current firm since 2006, kind of moved this direction after tort reform kind of took a turn that as a civil defense lawyer, insurance defense lawyer for years. You know, I kind of went away from that, started to specialize in appellate practice and started doing a lot of other things too that aren't litigation related, but I still continue to practice appellate law and I love it. The legislative stuff is somewhat of a hobby. It is also what I consider to be a form of public service because, you know, I don't get paid to do any of this. I just track legislation for civil trial and appellate lawyers and judges. I'm not sure why I'm wired that way, but I enjoy doing it. I hope the updates that everyone receive are helpful. They're bipartisan, or I should say nonpartisan, really. You know, I try to keep it that way. And that way it reaches a wider audience. And I think folks appreciate me calling balls and strikes, if you will, just presenting information and people can take it and do with it whatever they want. So I don't know if that answered the question about a little bit more about me, but that'll get us started anyway.
No, it absolutely did. And, you know, I'll tell you from my personal perspective, I think your emails are super helpful just because they do. They break down, here's what's going on in the legislature. You don't put spin on it. It's just, here's what's happening. Here's where these bills are. Here's what they're about. Here's, you know, where they are in the process and just kind of things you need to know, which is a fantastic resource because trying to get that information on every individual bill, it really does take a lot of time and effort, even though we have, I think, a pretty good legislative website to track that stuff. You'd mentioned it. How did you get interested in following the legislature?
Well, the tort reform effort in the early 2000s, HB4, is what everybody in the profession knows it as. You know, it kind of crept up on a lot of us, I think, at least for me, not really paying attention. And it was a significant change to my practice area. And since that happened, I thought, you know, I really need to start paying attention about what the legislature is doing. I don't have the stroke, if you will, to really make changes or know the right people. At least I didn't at the time. But I thought I could be more involved. And then an opportunity came up. And Jody, I don't remember if you were practicing at Kelly Hart in 2004. That may have been right before your arrival there.
Right before I started, yep.
Okay. In March of 2004, the Tarrant County Bar Appellate Section had a luncheon. I was chair of the section that particular year, and we had a former Chief Justice, Linda Thomas, come speak to our bar about issues that were going to be affecting the judiciary that were coming up in 2005. And at the forefront of that effort, it was really going to be the judicial pay raise that they would eventually receive during that session. But she came and spoke to our section and had made a comment about what, in addition to what they were going to be looking for or what the judiciary was going to be dealing with and looking for help on, really wanting some lawyers to kind of help disseminate information to members of the bar to kind of help spread the word, if you will, about what was going to be coming down the pike the next session. You know, silly me, I just said, Judge, I'd love to help. I don't know what I can do, but I'd like to be of help. And she said, well, I can use you. So what I started doing then was really just tracking those specific initiatives that were going to be dealt with that next session. And it's kind of evolved into what it is now, from being just kind of a local thing up in Tarrant County in Dallas, in Dallas County in that area, to more of a statewide sort of a database or distribution list or whatever you want to call it. It's really evolved into what it is now. So I blame or I bless Justice Thomas for getting me involved in this. I enjoyed doing it, and I'll continue to do it until someone tells me to go away.
You mentioned House Bill 4. Were you doing Med-Mal defense work back around that time in 03?
We'd had a couple of cases then, but it was primarily just your routine, you know, auto accidents, construction accidents, things along those lines. But obviously HB4 was the focus point was Med-Mal at that point in time, but it filtered into other areas. But that spurred me on.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
I've always been impressed at just the depth with which you're able to cover different pieces of legislation and doing it not only in that depth, but, you know, tracking bills as they go, even, you know, from the earliest stages when they first come in, because we generally, you know, get wind of things that might be coming down the pike in the legislature. And, you know, your reports are real good at you identify what's coming and then you track it all the way through to when things are passed and signed by the governor. And I'll tell you that there's a few people whose judgment I really rely on. I rely a lot on Steve Hayes to tell me about error preservation. And you're kind of up there in the Steve Hayes stratosphere when it comes to legislative issues. So I'll compliment you there. But that really is a great service that you provide. And I can't imagine who else would come to mind when someone talks about, well, what's going on with this bill? It's like, well, he better call Jerry Bullard. He probably knows off the top of his head.
Well, I appreciate that. And like I said, I've gotten to the point where if I don't know about it, I can usually find out fairly quickly. So and that helps, you know.
Before we stray too far, these are emails that you send out. You just maintain a Outlook distribution list, or how are you keeping track of these?
Well, yeah, I mean, right now it's kind of a dual track thing. I've got an Outlook old fashioned email format, but I've also moved over a little bit to another platform, MailChimp, that allows me to get to more people without having to deal with a lot of, spam filters and the like. And so between those two platforms, you know, it goes to about 500, 600 people I know directly. And then I've been told it gets disseminated, you know, to different groups and different folks. So I know it reaches a lot of folks, but I just kind of maintain that list as I go. And whoever wants to be added. It doesn't have to be lawyers. And, you know, matter of fact, I've got judges and I got legislative staffers on there who rely on it because they can't keep track of everything either. So I've been told they enjoy it. So it's a big list, but I'm still trying to improve on the product though, because they get lengthy and I try to create links and make them really user friendly. It's easier said than done, as right now I'm the only one doing it.
If somebody wants to get on that list, what's the best way to do it?
Well, someone can send an email to my work address, which is jdb@all-lawfirm.com. Or I've got a personal one that I still give out. It's j.bullard1@verizon.net. And so if anybody wants to shoot me an email, they can do that. Or if the MailChimp version gets circulated around, some folks still get it. And I've noticed people have been subscribing through that feature too. So.
Well, we've kind of covered the creation of the list and how you go about it. It's got to just take an immense amount of time to do that. I can only imagine.
It's gotten a little bit easier. Jody alluded to it earlier. You know, the Texas legislature has a website and you can track bills that way if someone wants to do it by clicking on particular bills and wanting to follow them. But once you kind of figure out that process, you know, it's pretty easy to do. There's a lot of late nights and weekends that I've spent doing, putting those things together, the updates, a lot of phone calls during the week. But, you know, once you kind of get into the rhythm, it's not too difficult, really. It's just a lot of work. Not patting anybody's self on the back here, but I mean, it's just, it'd be nice to have some folks to help. And I had a few people who offer to, and they start to, but they just kind of say, well, I can't do that. So hopefully I'll find someone to pass the baton to at some point whenever I decide to give it up.
Well, there you go. Hopefully by saying that here on our show, you'll draw some interest.
Yeah. If anybody's listening.
Yeah. Feel free to jump in. The water's warm.
One thing I wanted to say before we got too far into the actual legislative issues is that we're anticipating that this is going to be a two-part episode, really two separate episodes, this one being sort of a prologue to the 87th legislative session. And then we anticipate, Jerry, bringing you back when the session's over. I'm not going to make you make any firm predictions or anything like that, but maybe we can discuss some things and hear it today. And then when we're done and the second time around, we'll kind of get the debriefing of what actually happened.
Okay. No, I'm happy to do that. I mean, just generally speaking, you know, there's about 7,000 bills that are filed each session. And so I try to, I'd actually scan every one of them that come in. Sometimes I don't get past the captions because, you know, you have to make sure the caption matches what the substance of the bill is. And so, you know, I'm able to keep track of those things and I follow them after that. By the end of the session, we'll probably have about, you know, 1,500 bills that actually pass. So a lot of those that start out at the beginning fall by the wayside because, as a lot of folks like to say, it's easier to kill a bill than it is to pass one. So, you know, hopefully, maybe not hopefully, depending on what it is, there'll be something to track and talk about at the end of the session too. I mean, there are always lots of interesting stories. We'll see what happens.
What are the areas that you typically focus on when you're looking through bills and the things that you like to track?
Well, I'm looking for primarily, you know, bills that affect civil trial lawyers and appellate lawyers and judges. So I'm looking at things that deal with civil litigation. Last session, the Texas Citizens Participation Act was a hot topic. And so, you know, when that one was coming down the pike, I got advance notice on at least a couple of those. But those are the things I'm looking for. You know, anything really that impacts our practice area as civil trial lawyers and appellate lawyers and judges, I'm looking for. And, you know, if there's some things that affect lawyers in general, like last session, we had folks that were advocating having basically a fast pass through all the courthouses, you know, across the state. Things like that I'm looking for, too. Just really things that I think might appeal to practitioners like us. There'll be some bills I'll just kind of throw in, too, from time to time that I think might be of interest. This session, we're going to have a lot of COVID-related bills. Mm-hmm. There's probably going to be some limitation on liability legislation filed to deal with that. So I'll be keeping track of those things. Separation of powers issues, you know, how the governor can decide whether or not to declare an emergency situation. That doesn't really affect us day to day, at least as practitioners necessarily. But as y'all both know, when that happens, then that triggers other things happening, such as the Supreme Court having authority to start modifying or suspending rules and things along those lines. So, you know, things that may not jump out at us as being practitioner, civil trial, appellate related, I'll keep track of those sorts of things too. And that's going to be a big topic this session, obviously, is the coronavirus and budgets and, you know, redistricting at different levels. You know, I'm thinking we may have a special session to deal solely with redistricting because I just can't see how that's going to get done during the, you know, 170 days, 140 days, whatever that time frame is during the regular session is to be able to get that accomplished, plus deal with just everyday stuff passed through the legislative process.
Yeah, it sure seems like COVID's going to dominate, at least in the beginning, and probably much longer. You reminded me, I'm trying to remember, I think it was maybe Judge Howell when he was on our show, talked about how, you know, people forget that little things like these emergency orders are what allow the courts to proceed in remote proceedings. And that if there's going to be some kind of permanent fix to this, then it's going to have to be legislative, which will be interesting to be on the lookout for.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there'll be legislation to deal with it from a statutory standpoint, but there's also going to be budget issues, obviously, that we're going to have to deal with to fund some of those operations. I know the Supreme Court, the Judicial Council has passed resolutions to deal with wanting the legislature to make sure there's additional, there's a sufficient funds to be able to deal with continuing with remote hearings in the future and security issues dealing with not only just access to the courtrooms, but, health protections and things like that. That's going to be something I'll be tracking too, just because it impacts what we do.
Yeah, we won't really think about, the additional expenses that are going to come along with making jury trials safe again. And I know, up to now, I assume that the plexiglass and so forth that's been installed in courtrooms, although nobody's really been in courtrooms very much, I know there's been some of that undertaken. There are going to be some budgetary needs, I would imagine, to try and accommodate what we think we need to do to get juries back in the courtrooms.
Yeah, no, you're right. And that in addition to, because of the shutdown of businesses, oil and gas, all those things impact what the state's revenue stream is. And so, you and I have all heard about potential issues with budget cuts that are affecting every government agency, every branch of government, according to the judiciary, which could end up affecting the court's operations in terms of having to cut staff, things along those lines that since I've started doing this, I have a new appreciation for. Some of the things that we don't see happen, when we go into a courtroom, but staff and being able to keep courts functioning, it's staff attorneys, it's clerks, we're talking people.
Oh, right.
Well, and our judiciary already operates on a pretty slim budget. So it's not like there's a lot of fat to trim anyway, which means you have to start cutting people, unfortunately.
That's right.
I think that's a really dangerous area to get into. I know that the courts were told, just like every other state agency, I think that they had to cut their budgets by, I don't know if it was 5% or what the percentages were, but maybe you know that, Jerry, but when you talk about, you don't really have much overhead other than staff costs. Trying to do that in a court system, the necessary result of that, if it actually goes through and there's not some new appropriation, is that the work of the court suffers and the public suffers from things being slowed down. And there's just ramifications to it that go far beyond just telling an erstwhile state agency, cut your budget 5%.
Yeah, that's right. And one thing I've also learned since I started paying attention to this process and was really, there's still a struggle between the legislative branch and the judiciary when it comes to funding and kind of what you talked about, Jody, about the portion of the budget being so small for the judiciary compared to the rest of the budget, that it's been disappointing to me at some level, at least when I first started. I mean, there's a good relationship between the judiciary and the legislature from my perspective. But when I first started into doing this, was seeing there's still a somewhat of a level of disrespect's not the right word, but it's kind of like, you're the less important branch of government here. So just, you get what you get and you don't throw a fit, what I tell my kids, And I think that somehow the mentality that the legislature has had in the past to our judiciary, but that's improved from my standpoint since I've started paying attention. Maybe I'm just misreading the tea leaves on that front. But it's still something I think as practitioners, we can still chime in on whenever the judiciary needs help on something like that. We can chime in on, whether it be people that we know, phone calls we can make to people that, we know can make a difference. Those are things that we can do. And that's one thing I've liked about what I'm doing with the legislative stuff is trying to educate folks on that front too, not just about legislation that affects what they do, but also how what the legislature does from a budget standpoint affects what we do.
It also helps, I think, just to be reminded of what that whole process is really like.
Mm-hmm.
The legislative process, as you pointed out, there are a lot of bills that don't get passed. And I do like about your reports, especially when you've noted that something's gone to committee and the committee versions of things are being worked out and, really being able to kind of get a sense of what actually might make it, because there so often you see things that get introduced that you feel like, okay, maybe that seems like a good idea, but just, you know, the politics of the time or whatever are not going to actually allow that to get pushed through. And so often that turns out to be true, but it's really nice to see the fruit of your work when something gets pushed through. And I think the words you usually use are, you know, bills sent to the governor, something like that. And so you really can see what's about to happen and almost in real time, because your updates are so frequent when things get to that point. But
well, I appreciate that.
What's going on with the judicial selection this session? I know we had the commission that was appointed and met and kind of came up with some findings. What do you see on the horizon there?
Well, going in to, well, the past several sessions, there have been bills that have been proposed that have sought to change how our judges are selected. And every time one has been filed, it's been, okay, yeah, that's nice. Let's have a discussion, but it's not going to go anywhere because the political will doesn't exist to change the way we do it. Then you add in this layer of, well, you're wanting to change the system now because your side's losing. And so let's talk about changing it whenever your side's not losing. Maybe we'll listen. Well, usually that means someone else is losing the next time. Well, last session, as you know, as you referred to earlier, there was a commission on judicial selection appointed, and they went through the process of studying all these different systems. And the report came out December 18th, I think, where they essentially said, where you had 8 of the 7 members say, you know, we think we need to move away from partisan judicial elections. And you had 7 who said, no, let's keep it the way that it is. Well, 7 of those who said, let's keep it the way that it is, are some pretty powerful legislators. And so, you know, I don't think anybody, even though people think they want to change, I don't think anybody really expects any changes to occur in terms of how we select judges this session. And when you put on top of that, this whole COVID thing and the budget and everything else we're going through, you know, it's going to be a low priority item from a legislative standpoint. However, what the commission said was, and I think it was near unanimous, well, we need to really look at judicial qualifications. What qualifications do we want to put on our trial judges, our appellate judges, et cetera, before they can be appointed, run, or however they get to that spot? We want to be able to deal with that. So I think we will see something. Not sure how far it's going to go, but we will see some legislation dealing with judicial qualifications. I think there was another item that they talked about. I'm going to look at my notes here real quick. They had mentioned, we're talking about looking at rule changes, perhaps, to regulate the role of money in our judicial campaigns and election process. So, you know, those rules are tweaked all the time. I don't know what they have in mind, but I think we may see something there that'll get a whole lot further down the trail than changing the way we elect judges or select judges. I don't know that change is going to come in my lifetime. I guess it could. I don't see any major changes to that part of it, but things like qualifications. Once again, bills that get proposed every session deal with qualifications too, but they don't get too far down the trail. But who knows here? You know, there's some interest there, and I think there's across the board interest to make something like that happen. So I would expect to see that make some progress. We'll see if anything comes out of it.
Mm-hmm. That seems like a fairly decent compromise position to take, because we've got, even here on our show, you know, Justice Green came on, and as he was leaving the bench and decried the whole system of money going into judicial elections. And then Justice Benavidez came on but a few weeks later and said, well, it would just be wrong to pick our judges any other way. But I suspect that they probably would both agree with something to do with qualifications being fleshed out, and also something to do with money. You know, it's hard to argue with the idea that, you know, we're in a democracy. We ought, the will of the people ought to be how some of our elected officials are chosen, and including judges. But those are the two real sticking points the commission has addressed that might help kind of get us through, as you say, probably a lower priority item this session overall. But some of those items, you know, wouldn't necessarily be as controversial as trying to revamp the whole system in these times.
It'll become controversial when you start putting meat on the bones as to what those qualifications ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
you know, board certification was talked about, but I think that's probably not going to get too far because there are good judges who are never board certified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, years of service, I could see that becoming an issue. Years of practice, I could see that becoming an issue. Could get addressed just because of what we experienced in, well, in the Dallas County sweeps and in Harris County. And Todd, I'm not sure about Travis County, but I mean, you've had some judges and that have come in that just, you know, are just barely across the line in terms of being qualified under state law to be judges. And some of them don't have any sort of experience in the practice areas that their courts are most likely going to see. I mean, they're good folks and hopefully they'll be great judges, but learning on the job is kind of a tough thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Learning on the job with no staff. I mean, you know, we've seen appellate judges take the bench with little to no appellate experience, but they've got, you know, appellate experts in the office next door helping them do the job. This is a different situation.
Well, that's true. That's true. I know in Tarrant County, there's not a staff attorney system at the trial court level. I think they hire interns to kind of help them from time to time, but they don't have that support, like you said, Todd, at least up in Tarrant County. Harris and Dallas, I think, may have a little bit of a system there, but I don't know. But now, those will be some things that'll be talked about, and they'll probably make some headway. I just don't know how much.
What are some other things that appellate and civil practitioners ought to keep eyes out for?
Well, you know, there is, I think we will see probably some other attempt to deal with courthouse access for attorneys. I know the bill that got proposed last session didn't get too far. You know, there was a pretty good compromise, I think, at some point for the state bar to maybe have some input on who gets that access. But once again, you know, you got to coordinate with local law enforcement, security in all different sorts of counties and different areas to see if that gets anywhere. I would think we might see a bill filed there. I don't know exactly how far that might go. From an appellate standpoint, you know, one bill to keep an eye on is one filed by Representative King up here, HB 339, dealing with the composition of court of appeals districts. That original bill filed dealt with overlapping jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
To remove those overlapping jurisdictions in Texarkana, Tyler, and the Dallas Court of Appeals districts. But I've been told that's a placeholder bill for a likely larger redistricting effort amongst the courts of appeals. What that looks like, no one knows yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been told by a few different folks that says, there's an interest in doing that this session. So for the appellate lawyers, that'll be really interesting to see how that plays out, because it would probably involve a reduction in the number of appellate court justices. Well, justices, but also just jurisdiction. So there would be winners and losers. And every time that's been attempted in the past, you know, it's been able to be held off by our judges. Well, not necessarily by the judges, but by the legislators who have an interest in maintaining a court of appeals in their town. And anyway, so that's something to take a look at and to keep an eye on, because that's going to probably become a little bit more than just removing a few counties from appellate districts. So that's one thing that I know you, all three of us, will really be interested in.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a bill filed dealing with the practice of law license about discrimination against, you know, anti-discrimination type bills for lawyers who may want to exercise some sort of a constitutional right. Religious freedom issues or whatever it may be, that action can't be taken against their law license because of that. So that was a bill filed by Representative Perry just a few weeks ago. He's not a lawyer, but I understand he's got an interest in that issue. And so from a lawyer standpoint, anything that affects our license, you know, we want to know about. So that'll be something that we'll have to keep an eye on. Those are the main ones that jump out at me, other than we already talked about judicial selection. At one time, we thought we may hear again about the business court bill, the chancery court bill that would create a whole new trial court system for business disputes and a whole new court of appeals for business dispute appeals. You know, so there was some talk that may find its way back into the legislative process this year. I'm not sure if that's going to get too far because of everything else going on, but, you know, we could still see something along those lines that it impacts what we do on a daily basis. Those are the ones that I would think of that jump out at me as affecting what we do. There's a couple of bills filed that deal with medical expenses and how you recover those. It's kind of the paid incurred on steroids, I've told a few people. SB 207 is going to talk about when you can recover medical expenses. There's some different methods of trying to figure out how that's calculated. Those bills were filed by Senators Schwertner, Buckingham, and Campbell, all physicians, all Republicans. The Senate's, you know, still in control of the Republican Party. So, you know, things like that could make its way down the trail a little bit further than it otherwise would have.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. Are you hearing anything about any further efforts to rein in the TCPA? There were some folks that really, you know, proclaimed what happened last session as being a really good thing, kind of sort of narrowing the scope of the statute. But then other folks were saying, well, that's great, but it really didn't go far enough. So I'm curious if your ear to the ground is catching anything on that.
Now, I hear those rumbles too, or rumbles or grumbles, whatever you want to call them. And I've not heard anybody from a legislator standpoint say, you know, that's something we want to take on again. You know, that was really a monumental effort last session to deal with the TCPA. You know, Chairman Leach over in the House was instrumental in making that happen. A lot of players came together to make that happen. There was a lot of oxygen, once again, taken out of the room dealing with that particular statutory scheme. And it was a heavy lift. And it took a lot of time and effort. So, you know, to make that happen again, I just don't see it. But, you know, who knows?
Maybe not this session. Maybe we go through another cycle.
One issue that I think will still come up that always comes up in terms of, you know, questions from people on my distribution list when I speak at events, is the legislature going to fix Chapter 38 and the award of attorney's fees issue? Because right now, you know, there's case law that basically says, well, you can only recover attorney's fees from individuals and corporations, or at least you have a contract that provides for that or another statute that provides for that. The past three or four sessions, those attempts to modify that statute, even though the stars are aligned politically, have never gotten across the finish line.
Yeah, the big issue there being, or LLC is going to be held liable for fees under
LLCs, LPs.
LPs.
Anything that doesn't fall into the corporation or individual category. I've got theories about why those bills didn't get across the finish line, you know, and a lot of times it may be associated with who carries a bill. You know, someone stepped on someone's toes somewhere and they didn't like that, so therefore their bill doesn't get anywhere. You know, there's interesting things, interesting stories that come out of this whole process that are just fascinating to me.
Well, we might have to earmark a couple of those for the next time you're on the show.
No, I mean, that's one I'm always looking for. So I bet we'll see something along those lines again.
Yeah, that's one of those kind of bizarre, unintended consequence kind of laws that it is surprising that we've gone this many sessions since that's become an issue and it hasn't gotten fixed yet.
Yeah, well, you know, first time the bill got introduced a few sessions ago, you know, there were rumblings about oil and gas companies opposing it because they liked operating as LPs and they liked not having that exposure. Because I found a lot of their contracts that I reviewed never addressed attorney's fees. So they kind of liked having that protection. I don't know if that's what derailed it the first time. There were some rumors to that effect. But in any event, it's something everybody agrees that needs to be fixed. It's just whether or not the politics will let it happen.
It's a big issue because there's so much litigation in the energy sector. I mean, you look at the Supreme Court's docket, it seems like every oral argument setting has one case, or every other setting has at least one case where it's, you know, oil and gas rights at issue, mineral rights at issue. So,
yeah,
this is a real thing.
Yeah, it's a huge issue and a huge financial or potential financial problem for some of these entities that have to deal with it, at least until they get their contracts cleaned up, I'm guessing. So.
So this is the same industry that, you know, so much of it turns on 1/8 royalties and 1/8 of royalties and, you know, stuff that's just archaic. So good luck with cleaning up the contracts.
Yeah, that's true.
as we're kind of moving towards the end here, I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the State Bar Appellate Section, which you're the current chair of.
Okay. Yeah, I'm honored to be chairing the section. I mean, both of y'all are members, and I think it's one of the best sections that the State Bar has. And the feedback we always get from our attendees, our conferences, and our members is that it's just a great section to be a part of. The disappointing thing, of course, is that everything's going to be remote.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I like to be an introvert sometimes, but I like to get out and visit with people and, you know, find ways to increase our members and find ways to provide services to members that we already have that maybe we're missing somewhere, you know. So I had looked forward to that opportunity to be able to kind of hear those ideas and hopefully implement those ideas. We can still do it remotely through Zoom and remote features like this. And we had, you know, the Hidalgo County Bar Association Appellate Section and the State Bar sponsored a joint session, a joint CLE back in the fall. That at the time was one of the largest attended by Zoom events that the bar had offered. So we know we have a product that can appeal, for lack of a better word, to a lot of folks, you know, that are in these areas that we can't get to physically. So, you know, I want to be able to continue to, you know, to do that. And then in December, you know, the Historical Society and the Appellate Section sponsored in an evening with the Supreme Court that I think, you know, set all kinds of records on the Supreme Court's website as far as views for an event. I think it was over 11,000 then who viewed the event. And as y'all know, I doesn't necessarily mean everyone's sitting there looking at the whole thing all the way through. There's revisits, things like that. But that's an awesome number. So there's ways that we can continue to expand our section, both by membership and visibility, hoping to continue to be able to do that for the rest of my term as chair, whatever that may look like. But we're always looking for great ideas, too. So if anybody has any wonderful ideas or the ways that we can improve our product and improve our services, we're all ears. And you can send that information to me. You can reach out to Todd or Jody, whoever you can think of as an appellate lawyer, because they'll know how to get the information to the right people.
That Supreme Court event, that joint event with the Supreme Court Historical Society really was great. And, you know, the other sort of flagship event the section puts on every year is the Advanced Appellate Seminar. And, you know, now that we've got news of a vaccine, I'm going to hold out a little hope that we'll actually be able to get together in person. But, you know, there's so much lead time that goes into running these events and planning. Who knows what will happen between now and Labor Day, which is generally when that event takes place. But it's such a, you always have an all-star lineup and the topics covered are just tremendous. And I'm going to hold out some hope that we can resume doing that in person, hopefully this next time around.
Well, I am too. Justice Busby is going to program director for our advanced course. And we're still working on a program director for 101. But I think that committee is probably going to try to meet in February. So if anyone out there has an idea for a topic or speaker, feel free to, you know, let us know those ideas too, because I know we'll be looking to fill that roster with, like you said, that all-star lineup we always have. We'll continue to do that, but we want to hear some new voices and some new ideas too.
Well, I'm going to make a shameless plug to do a live recording of the Texas Appellate Law podcast. If and when it will resume live and in person eventually, but we've joked around a few times that that's something we'd really like to do. It would be really fun to spend 30 or 45 minutes recording live.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is a great idea. I hadn't thought of that. See, we got good ideas coming from within.
Busby's listening. Judge, you know where to find us.
That's right.
I'll make sure he gets the message if he's not listening. But no, I think that's a great idea. Not, like you said, Todd, we have no idea if they're going to be live or Zooming again next September. Hopefully it'll be live. But if not, even if it's live, we may be able to put something together.
What would the site be this year if it is a live event?
Well, there was a little bit of a scheduling snafu, so it won't be at the Four Seasons this year, but it will be across the street at the new Hyatt. I think it's the Hyatt. There's a Hilton. It's Hyatt or Hilton. I forget which one it is right now. No, it's a Marriott. It's a new Marriott right across the street.
Okay.
From the Four Seasons. It will be the weekend before Labor Day. Not the weekend before Labor Day, the week before Labor Day instead of after. Apparently, there's some religious holidays that are falling on that week after, and there's some scheduling issues, like I said, with the Four Seasons. That's going to be a brand new venue for this year. The Supreme Court Historical Society Hemphill Dinner will still occur. It'll be across the street, still at the Four Seasons, but we're planning on having it in Austin at the new Marriott, right across the street from the Four Seasons.
Very cool.
Keep my fingers crossed all that happens live and in person. The section and the society both have, you know, did really well with adjusting to doing things on Zoom. But as you suggest, Jerry, it's not the same. I miss seeing my appellate friends at the seminars, and hopefully we can get back to that, you know, by September. We'll just hold out hope.
Me too. Like I said, I enjoy being able to chair the section as great as this one, but it's sure not the same.
Well, we appreciate the job you're doing. And
definitely, it's not an easy job.
It's not an easy job. And, you know, the section does maintain pretty high level of visibility. It's got a great website, a lot of resources available. If anyone who's a listener who's not already a member and isn't familiar with the State Bar of Texas Appellate Section should definitely check it out. And it's one of the best bargains in town. I think it's another $30 or $35 off your state bar dues.
It's $25 annual dues. And one of our most popular features that we have to remind even our members that we have is that part of that, you get free online CLE, which, you know, is pretty normal now. But we typically have around 14, 15, 16 hours of CLE content on our website, including, you know, enough ethics credit that you could join the section, get all your CLE credit, ethics too, taking part in reviewing our online library. So, I mean, that's a great feature. In addition to, you have the Appellate Advocate. Both of you gentlemen have served as editors of that publication that we continue to publish. And it gets republished or distributed by Westlaw and Lexis and those databases. So there's statewide and nationwide exposure to those who want to submit articles, which we're always looking for good articles for that publication too. So lots of opportunities for folks to get involved, volunteer as much as they want to, get involved as much as they want to. We just need to know you're interested.
Great networking opportunity and chances for mentorship and across law firms and things as well.
That's right. I mean, we have a lot of judicial participation too. So it's networking with colleagues, but also interfacing with a lot of our judges. So, and they're always participating. They're always happy to.
Well, we're coming to the end of the time we had allotted, Jerry. You've been very gracious with your time today. Thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Definitely.
We don't want to let you go before giving you the chance to tell us a Jerry Bullard tip or a war story, not necessarily legislative related, but it certainly could be. You alluded to some juicy stories that come out of past legislative sessions. So we'll just leave it to you to tell us what you think would be interesting.
Well, you know, one thing I've learned, and I knew this before I even got into this position, but, you know, one thing I tell young lawyers, whether they're trial lawyers, appellate lawyers, or what have you, is, you know, the clerks, the staff attorneys, the folks that aren't wearing the robes, I mean, they can be your best friend or your worst enemy, you know, depending on how you treat them, whether it be in what you're writing or how you're talking to them on the phone or in person. So, you know, always show those folks with respect, the respect they deserve, because they're hardworking folks. And, you know, that's one thing, just a practical tip that goes beyond just our writing skills and things like that. But just those are just interpersonal skills that I always like to share with folks. Same thing when I'm working in the legislature, you know, everyone focuses on the senators and the reps, but, you know, the staff people who run those offices, help make connections, you know, those are the folks you need to be talking to and showing appreciation to. But if I was going to share a war story coming out of all this, if for lack of a better word, you know, and this kind of gets back to how I've learned how the process works between our legislature and our judiciary. Like I said, it's changed since my first exposure to it. In 2004, after Justice Thomas got me involved, I decided I was going to go down to my first committee hearing. And that was a redistricting committee. And they had called all the chiefs down to a legislative conference room on the House side. So here we are, I was down there, I was meeting people that I'd only heard about, you know, chiefs of all the intermediate appellate courts. And we sat around and we waited and we waited and we waited. They never had a quorum. There was never a quorum of legislators there. And so they said, or I think the chair came out and said, well, sorry, your honors, but we don't have a quorum. Can y'all come back next week? You know? And so It was at that point I realized that the idea that I had about there was this kumbaya that existed between our public officials on all sides and a mutual respect that was shown there. You know, to me, I kind of saw, you know, maybe the judiciary are treated like poor stepchildren to some degree. And that stuck with me. And so part of what I like to do now is try to educate folks about those things. I think things have improved, at least from my perspective, that relationship, that dialogue. But that's not really a war story, but it was just kind of an eye-opener to me about what we, as we advocate for our clients, we advocate our positions and make arguments, but we're also officers of the court, we're representatives of the judicial system, and we have an obligation, I think, to speak up to protect that system and to protect our judges. I could go off on my whole attacks on the judiciary spill. That's another topic for another day. There's several judges that I've had the opportunity to present with to deal with those issues and talk some of those things through. One of them, Jody, you're a partner with. Another judge, Judge Livingston in Austin, was on a panel with me. Todd, I'm sure you're familiar with her.
I am.
Just wonderful people that you meet along the way, mm-hmm. who you have a kindred spirit with, at least with respect to how the judiciary ought to be treated. So, you know, so that's not really a war story. That's still a good way to think about, you know, why I do what I do anyway. Mm-hmm. Got me started.
That's a great way to wind us up.
It is.
I do want to again mention that, you know, we're going to bring you back to do a debriefing or a postmortem on the session after it's done, and we'll see what actually transpired over the coming months. It's going to be interesting for sure.
Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to do that. I enjoy getting to do those things. So.
We look forward to having you back. Before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please send an email to hosts@techsapplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter @texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.